Welcome to another episode of Commission Chats. I'm your host, John Scapini. Commission Chats is a podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the United States Sentencing Commission. Today is part two of our Problem Solving Courts miniseries, where we'll be joined by Judge John Gleason. We'll be discussing alternatives to incarceration programs and problem-solving courts in the Eastern District of New York. If you want to listen to the first episode in this ATI miniseries with Judge Phil Restrepo, it's now available on iTunes. I'll now pass it over to my colleague, Lori Baker, who recently spoke with Judge Gleason.
Good afternoon, Judge Gleason.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us today to talk about problem-solving courts. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you were on the bench, what you've done professionally?
Sure. After a stint, after graduating law school, I spent the obligatory stint in a big firm, which is a typical track for New York lawyers. Then I was 10 years as a prosecutor, an assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, followed by 22 years as a district judge in the same courthouse, the Eastern District of New York. And in 2016, I left that job and joined private practice at Debevoise in Plimpton, where I'm a partner today.
Okay. So as a judge in the Eastern District of New York, you became involved with problem-solving courts.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that started for you?
Sure. It began with the explosion in the prison population that was ushered in by our move to determinate sentencing regimes in the federal system and in the state systems, beginning in the late 80s. And there came a point in the early part of this century when there was kind of a recognition that maybe we ought to think about other ways to deal with people who became involved in the criminal justice system. And the programs I'll talk about in a moment were inspired to a significant degree by the reentry programs that began to crop up in the federal system beginning around 2002. My colleague Judge Restrepo is a leader, a thought leader, and an action leader with regard to those reentry programs. And inspired by those, and inspired by a trip to the Ninth Circuit Judicial Conference in 2010, I and some others thought, why don't we think about maybe upfront no-entry programs, not programs that assisted people in the reentry phase after they served their terms of imprisonment, but whether there were segments of the defendant population in federal court that could avoid prison.
So you're talking about pretrial programs. We talked with Judge Restrepo. He told us about the program in Philadelphia that is a traditional reentry program. You're talking about on the other side at the pretrial stage.
Yes, and we like to call them alternative to incarceration programs, no entry programs. And to get more specific, one program that was directly inspired by the reentry programs was a no-entry drug court. Okay. In which, let me talk a little bit to frame the issue for our listeners, in which we selected defendants who were charged with nonviolent crimes, had a documented history of substance abuse. They were not leaders or managers of criminal enterprises. And it was clear, and it's remarkable how easily this is to ascertain, it was clear that they became involved in the criminal justice system because of their addictions. So the thought was, with respect to those, rather than wait for them to serve prison terms and put them in a reentry drug court, let's move that up front, adjourn their sentence to allow them to participate in a judge-involved drug treatment program, a drug court, inspired very much also by the successful programs in the states.
So you have two different programs that continue to operate in the Eastern District of New York. What are those called, and tell me the differences between the two.
Sure. A little bit more on the drug program. That's called the Pretrial Opportunity Program. You know, it was named by the Chief Pretrial Services Officer, and everybody figures out what the acronym is first, and then they create the name. So it's the POP program, the Pretrial Opportunity Program. And in that program, which we began, the Eastern District Board of Judges adopted it as a court-wide program in 2011. If the requirements were that the folks who had addiction problems, who were received into the program, were required to stay clean for 12 months. They were regularly tested. They were required to, if they didn't already have a GED, to get one. If they didn't already have a job, they were required to look for one. They were required to follow the rules related to their recovery. Some were required to have inpatient drug treatment, others outpatient drug treatment. And most importantly, and this is the defining characteristic of a drug court, they needed to meet with the other participants in the program and two judges, me and a magistrate judge who helped me found the program, in monthly meetings to talk about the problems they faced. And I want to focus on this a little bit, because what we learned from reading about these programs was what made them effective in the States was people who are in the criminal justice system interacting with judges, where judges are playing a constructive role, not looking down from the bench and taking a guilty plea and wagging their finger figuratively and sentencing them, but rather taking an interest in holistically in the rest of their lives. Many participants in the criminal justice system don't just have their criminal case. They've got housing court problems and family court issues. They're trying to get a job. And the social science that rose out of the state systems taught us that judges interacting in a constructive way helped with recovery and recovery retention and staying in recovery. But even more than that, what I'll take to my grave is the usefulness of the different participants in the program who were at different stages in the program. Some had been clean for 2 weeks. Some had been clean for 12 months. Some who graduated came back just to help the people in the program. And the way they cajoled one another, lectured one another, assisted one another when it came to what to do when they wanted to use, I found that to be infinitely more valuable to the participants in the program than what the judges could bring to bear. So it was not just transformative for them, it was transformative for me as a judge. I had been on the bench for 15 years when we first started thinking of this. And I thought I had been able to relate to the defendants who were in my courtroom before the drug court, before the POP court. But I was wrong. Seeing them as three-dimensional human beings was transformative for me.
So a really different experience for you than the traditional role of you being on the bench.
Absolutely. And both roles are obviously very important. Both are rewarding in their own ways. But being part of transforming their lives transformed my life.
Sounds like it gave you a lot of insight into other issues that were going on with those people that would come before you in court.
Yes. You know, it's people's lives can't be siloed. And understanding that made me a better judge.
So you have a second program that you're going to tell us about.
Yes. And it's called the SOS program, the Special Option Services Program, which actually began in the early part of the century just as a modality for pretrial services. And when we started the POP program, I asked the pretrial services officer in charge of SOS, would you like a judge as a tool in your toolbox, in much the same way that a judge and I should have emphasized this, the key to the success of these programs are the pretrial services officers, in some districts, probation officers, right, who deal hands-on. But I asked the pretrial services officer who was in charge of our SOS program, how would you like a judge to take the people you're supervising before? And she said yes. And to describe the program, it was for defendants who are 25 years or younger, charged with a nonviolent crime. And my district included Brooklyn and Queens and other parts of and Staten Island and Long Island. And there were so many young people in our caseload who grew up in circumstances where nobody told them to get out of bed in the morning and go to school or look for a job. They needed supervision. So we identified young men and women who would benefit from intensive supervision, and we gave it to them and made sure that they were in educational as a requirement. They had to be in educational or vocational programs. They needed to follow the directions of the unbelievably talented pretrial services officer who checked on them to make sure they were doing the sorts of things that people need to do in order to succeed.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about program successes and how you measure those successes.
Yes. And, you know, now that I'm on the commission, I'm even more attuned than I used to be to the fact that sentencing policy shouldn't be driven by anecdotes. It should be driven by data. And we started from the beginning of the POP and SOS programs to collect our own data about intake and the demographics of the people in the program, success rates, a little bit about the end results. They fell into essentially two categories, and it started out as strictly an ATI, Alternative to Incarceration program. But by the time, and programs around the country have different characteristics. In some of them, like the CASA program in Los Angeles, you know if you're a defendant what your quid pro quo is if you succeed. We didn't do it that way. We postponed the ultimate resolution until people either graduated from the POP program or from the SOS program. And in a way that advantaged the participants, because then the prosecutor made the ultimate decision as to how to proceed after the success had been achieved. So in the POP program, not only did 100% of the defendants not go to prison, but 40% of them had their charges dismissed entirely.
Okay.
By the U.S. attorney, a very important thing, because the collateral consequences of a conviction can't be overstated.
So typically you're working with these defendants after they've been charged, but prior to a plea, am I understanding correctly?
Sometimes they had pled guilty.
Okay.
But in those circumstances, when the U.S. attorney thought that the rehabilitation had been so dramatic, they would be permitted to withdraw their plea of guilty, and they would be given a deferred prosecution. So if they stayed on the straight and narrow for another year, the case would be dismissed entirely. Others, about 60%, did not have their cases dismissed, but there was no dispute in any of those cases with regard to departing downward to a sentence of probation as opposed to sending them off to prison.
So it sounds like you've had great success in diverting these individuals from either a prosecution altogether or a sentence of incarceration.
Absolutely, which in and of itself, a great thing. And then in addition, they turn their lives around.
Right.
One of them is a supervisor in the New York City Parks Department. Others got their CD, their commercial driver's license, and their bus drivers. One woman started an online retail outlet. And those are the things that, you know, whereas policy shouldn't be driven by anecdotes, anecdotes can inspire people to do the things, to collect the data, to make sure these things are actually as wonderful and as beneficial as they feel like they are when you're doing them.
What advice would you give to someone interested in starting up a pretrial diversion program?
Several pieces of advice. One, do it. Second, talk to the other folks around the country that have done it. This is a real grassroots movement. We were the first no-entry drug court. Now there are no-entry drug courts in more than 24 districts around the country, other courts as well, mental health courts. You know, they're tailored to the needs of the particular district. So one is to talk to other people. One thing we've done here at the commission level is create a central repository of information so that the different forms of these courts that have been created can be evaluated and seen. The biggest piece of advice is just do it. You know, the one thing I've learned is folks who, not everybody is a believer in this. Some people regard these things, they call them hug-a-thug, kumbaya courts. So it's okay. They don't have to be involved in it. Some judges don't think it's the proper judicial role. Many do. And a lot of people conjure up front all the different problems that can be created. What if two co-defendants are in the same drug court? What if? Most of those play out in ways that are not problems at all. So my strongest piece of advice for judges and probation officers and prosecutors and defenders who are interested in this is do it and learn as you go and make the right decisions. Look at if it's a drug court, take a look at the National Association of Drug Court Professionals website. There are best practices on there. These are, you know, for too long, the only currency we had in dealing with federal crimes was months and years and decades in prison. This is, for a segment of that population, this is a different way, a more constructive way, a less expensive way, a more humane way for us to deal with people who become enmeshed in the federal criminal justice system.
Thank you so much for meeting with us today and sharing your experiences. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the fact that you're interested in this, and I hope your listeners are as well.
Thank you. For those listeners searching for even more information on alternatives to incarceration, please visit our website at ussc.gov. If you hover over the education tab, you will see a link to problem-solving courts. As Judge Gleason mentioned, this page offers an interactive and filterable map of programs and contains links to supporting documentation. So if you're interested in starting an alternatives program, this is a great resource for you to look at. We continue to update this resource as information comes in, so please check back from time to time. And also feel free to reach out to us on the helpline if you have any questions. Commission Chats is now available on iTunes. Please be sure to rate, review, and follow the podcast there.